The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Army Sergeant Bob Bearden was a young paratrooper with the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment when he jumped into the skies over Normandy on June 6, 1944, D-Day. Thus began a remarkable story of battlefield action, capture by German forces, surviving POW camps, and finally a journey home that would take him halfway around the world by freight cars, wagons, on foot, and by ship, before he managed to get back to his native Southwest more than a year later. His saga begins in Oklahoma during the Depression.
I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and my father was quite wealthy in the oil industry. And as he told me, in about 1927, 8, along in there, the oil fell to such a price that he couldn't get for it what it cost to pull it out of the ground. So we were one of those Okie families that came to Texas with two mattresses on top of our car. And we went down to Irving, Texas, where my great aunt and uncle owned a hotel cafe in Irving. And so I spent, I was about 7 years old then. And we made a long trip out to California to visit another great aunt who was going to, I think, get my father some work out there. And that didn't work out, so we turned right around and drove that little whippet automobile that he had back across that desert and back to Irving. And so my father, during the Depression, moved. There are those in Oak Cliff in part of Dallas who say the Beardens moved every time the rent came due. And that was just seemed like it. I've probably gone to six grammar schools in Dallas and as many in Fort Worth. But we just moved all around the country. We moved up to Amarillo and moved down to Houston for a little while. So I was accustomed to making new friends, much like a military brat, you know.
Right.
I was accustomed to making friends, and it has benefited me, actually, in my life, that I'm not hesitant to meet new people, and I do it without any qualms. So.
But what prompted you to go into the Texas National Guard at such an early date?
Well, I was working for A&P. I was making 12 and a half cents an hour. And I was coming home from a dance one night, and my buddy Howard White was in ROTC in high school, and he was also in the National Guard, and he was a sergeant. And he started talking to me about, you know, we ought to go get Hitler, and I said, yeah, let's do it, you know. And he said, if you join, you go down to Louisiana maneuvers with us, you'll eat that good GI chow, and you'll come back weighing enough to play football. And besides that, you make a dollar at every National Guard meeting, which lasts 4 hours. So I'd be making 25 cents an hour. Well, that just doubles my A&P money. So, I mean, do the math there. It doesn't take any question about what kind of decision to make. So he was in the National Guard for some time and knew everybody. And so the night that the 144th Infantry left Dallas for Louisiana maneuvers in 1940, July the 20th, I was issued a full field pack, a rifle, bayonet, helmet, the whole nine yards, and we fell out and marched to a bagpipe band from the armory down on Akron Street all the way downtown to the Union Terminal in Dallas. And as a matter of fact, it's in the book. We went by the Majestic Theater, and the movie that was playing there was All This in Heaven, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when you joined up, you didn't expect what was going to come later in December of 1941, did you?
Oh, mercy, no. No, no. They were singing a song then, I'll Be Back in a Year, Little Darling. And all these guys were going into the Army for a year. And I felt like, you know, that's what we'll do. Well, it took 4 years, 11 months, and 20 days for me to do my year.
What about your first training? You went off to Fort Benning, as I recall.
Well, we were training. We trained for a year in Brownwood, Texas, 36th Division, until Pearl Harbor. When Pearl Harbor happened, they took my regiment, 144th, out and made it from a square division to a triangle division. They sent us to Fort Lewis, Washington, and we started immediately pulling guard duty going south down the west coast in anticipation of the invasion by the Japanese. And we were digging foxholes and gun emplacements as we went up and down that coast there. And we were stringing barbed wire all up and down all those mountains from Washington to California. And, man, I had about all that I wanted. It just didn't sound like the combat that I had anticipated. And so at one of the Louisiana maneuvers, we heard that there were some supermen down there. They were real unusual military. And they made $50 a month extra just for jumping out of airplanes. So $50 a month sounded good to me. And so Howard White and I signed up to go airborne. And we caught a train out of San Francisco and went through Dallas for a couple of days on down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where we, it was in September, we arrived at Fort Benning Jump School, and it took 4 weeks. That was a 4 week course. And the last week was making five jumps for your wings.
Well, before you made the jumps, you had to learn how to pack that chute.
And oh, yeah.
You described that in some detail about the fact that you were literally putting your own life in your own hands.
Yeah, the thing that made it more disturbing to me than perhaps some others was I've always known they had not identified this issue at the time, but I've been dyslexic all my life, and I don't retain anything that I read. I don't retain anything that I hear. And so when a man is standing up there telling you how to pack this parachute, and you know that you're not remembering it, it gets a little spooky.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure the first jump was a little spooky too, wasn't it?
Oh, mercy. It was, we jumped out of airplanes right off on the ground, going out that door, and the first time I went out that door at 1,200 feet, it was such a shock, I'll tell you. But the next jump, Billy Blancett, who was my best friend at the time, was next to me. And when the sergeant said, on the second jump, it was a Tuesday, the sergeant said, stand up and hook up, and I couldn't move. I just stood there. I was just staring across the aisle of this C-47, and Billy was over on the other side, and he reached over and grabbed me and jerked me and stood me up. He hooked me up. He checked my equipment, and he sounded off. Then they have sound off for equipment check. He sounded off for himself and then for me. When he just pushed me as we went out the door, and when that thing opened, I screamed, Blanchett, the SOB opened. I really thought I was jumping to my death. And the next day, if you can believe it,
you had to do the same thing to him.
I looked over here and Blanchett had that same look. I reached over, I grabbed him and said, hey, man, you got me into this thing now. Yeah. You're going too, believe me, you're going today. Get up here. And I jerked him up and hooked him up and did the same thing for him.
Well, you finally got those wings, however, and those paratrooper boots. And I'm sure when you got back to Texas, all the girls were chasing after you.
Oh, it was incredible. I can remember distinctly going downtown one day in the bright sunshine, and I was walking along pretty chesty with those big parachute wings on, you know, and my jump boots and that parachute cap on my head. And a little boy grabbed his mother and said, "Mommy, Mommy, a paratrooper, a paratrooper." Man, I swelled up like a frog, boy. I wish someone could have captured that and made a movie out of it. It was hilarious. As I look back on it now, I remember the exact sensation I felt. It was just like, man, I am one major hero.
Well, you were going to get a chance to prove that before very long, as it turned out. Tell us about your trip across the Atlantic.
Well, that was, we left Nebraska. I had a little trouble out there in Nebraska before we left. I had written Eleanor Roosevelt a letter saying that the Army wasn't letting us go home before we shipped overseas, and that wasn't right. And she wrote me back that ought to be something done about that. And so this is the wife of the President of the United States. So she wrote me back, and I had a letter to the editor in the Denver Post, I think it was. Anyway, I went to first sergeant. It was old, old, tough, tough sergeant. As a matter of fact, he's buried there in the Normandy Cemetery now. And I went to him and I said, "Well, guess what, Sergeant? You're going to have to let me go have a furlough." And he said, "You're not going anywhere, Beard." And so I said, "Well, I just went over the hill." Well, I didn't realize that I had signed a statement saying I'm aware that I'm alerted for overseas shipment. Now, that makes AWOL desertion.
Right.
And in time of war, they can shoot you for it.
But instead of going to prison, Bob Bearden would shortly be going to war. More on that when we return after these messages.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with Bob Bearden, author of To D-Day and Back. Although the invasion of Normandy in 1944 would ultimately succeed, it did not get off to an auspicious start, especially for the paratroopers who leapt into the dark skies over France in the early morning of June 6. Sergeant Bearden was one of those men.
Yes. A young man called me this morning from New Hampshire, and he'd just been over there visiting those hedgerows.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, he went out in those hedgerows, and he was commenting, "How in the world did you know which way to go?" You know, because the jump was completely messed up. Nobody hit their drop zone. 507 missed their drop zone worse than anybody. And so I had no idea where I was, no idea. But I heard some firing going off in the distance, and so I just started to go towards that because I assumed that was GIs shooting at Germans. And I thought at the moment, I hope it's not GIs shooting at GIs, which I had heard happen from time to time. So I just was wandering along, and some other was getting towards daylight, and another, 507, but 82nd Airborne paratrooper came up along me, and he looked at my sergeant stripes and decided that I knew everything, and he didn't know anything, so he joined me. We went down the road, and that's where I knocked on the front door of that first little farmhouse, and the next, that morning about 7 o'clock, I ran into Captain Taylor, and he had about, well, I don't know, maybe 60 men or so, something like that.
Move forward just a little bit and tell us about how you came to be captured by the Germans.
Well, we were in a situation. Colonel Millet was instructed by General Gavin, who was down on the Merrimack River, to come down to the river. We were up around Amperville, and he wanted us to come down to the river and join the division. What Millet must have had 400 men out there. He was completely surrounded, out of ammunition, just in a deplorable military situation. And he, so at first, Colonel Millet had told Captain Taylor in their communication to come over and join me. But he didn't mention really the fact that he was completely surrounded. But we went over there, and when we got just to the position and didn't really realize that we're at the position, that's when the sniper was eating us up and they called for a Tommy gun man. I went up front and had this crazy shootout, and I was sort of all by my, I was not sort of all by myself, I was by myself with a bunch of crouch, and I just shot everything that moved, and it was fortunate that I don't even know that anybody got a shot off at me. But anyway, we went into Millet's position. We stayed there a couple of days, and that's when Millet got the instruction to come join Gavin down by the railroad track and the bridge over the Merrimack. So in this trip, we ran across. We stopped at one point, and we could hear. From the other side of the hedgerows, you know, we were in a hedgerow pasture, and three of us recognized that we were hearing a machine gun being put in with a metal belt over in the far corner of the pasture, and three of us were down to phosphorus grenades, and that's what we threw, and none of us knew the other one was doing this at all. When those three grenades went off, these three Krauts screamed bloody murder. And somebody said, every man for himself. And man, these crazy paratroopers went back through a hole in the hedgerow and scattered all over. And I wound up, I bet I ran a mile. The next day, I got with Colonel Millet. I was with Colonel Millet and about 25 of us, and we started out again to go to the beach or the river, which is closer than the beach. We came into a pasture made by hedgerows, and the Germans had parachute flares thrown up right above us, and it was like being on a stage as an actor. And the audience is back behind the hedgerows in the dark. So we were just illuminated. And they started picking us off. They picked one guy off, hit him in the groin with a .30 caliber round, and he was gritting his teeth so loud to keep from exposing our position. It was just incredible. And finally, a guy from New York City named Tom Donahue, who's no longer with us, Tom said, in trying to speak German, said, "Ve surrender." Colonel Millet, who was laying back to my right rear, said, "Who said that?" Tom Donahue, buck sergeant, just like me, says, "I said that." Colonel Millet said, "Well, throw on your rifles and come on out." And he saved all of our lives, I'm convinced, by surrendering us, because we would never have gotten out of there alive. We didn't have any ammunition. I had 3 rounds left in my M1. And it was a hopeless situation.
Next, Bob Bearden describes life as a Nazi POW and his long journey back to the United States. We'll return after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center. an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
Feature for Harlem Operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and our guest this week is Bob Bearden, author of To D-Day and Back. Bob was a paratrooper with the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment who jumped into Normandy on D-Day in 1944. On day two of the invasion, he was captured by German forces, and his war became one of survival as he was shuttled from one prison camp to another, eventually was liberated by Russian army units, and then began a perilous trek that would bring him back home. We pick up his story at the point where he was picked up by German soldiers.
Well, it was, first of all, it was very peculiar because I'm the first generation Rotchen German family. I'm the first person who was born in this country of my ancestors who came from Germany. So when I got interrogated, they said, you know, what are you doing here fighting us? And I told them, you know, I was busy minding my business at Adamson High School when they started this whole thing. But we just, we walked almost to Paris, and we took trucks part of the way. And when they got to Paris, they marched us down from the Arc de Triomphe down this huge boulevard to the freight yards downtown Paris. And they the Germans got these French people to come out there and throw rocks and sticks, cuss us and spit on us, and it was horrible. And most of us, I bet 85% of us had been hit. And we were carrying one another along, you know, limping along. It looked like the Spirit of 76. And put us on those freight trains and gave us a little piece of cheese and a little piece of meat. And
you do describe in the book one bright moment, however, toward the end, as someone pulled a curtain back.
Yeah, one man down there, we were stopped at one moment, and I was just so depressed. And he pulled this lace curtain back and looked up and down. And when he didn't see any Germans looking at him, he flashed the V for victory sign. And, man, that pumped me up like I can't tell you what. I was so high. I was just ready to sick him. What do you got? We'll take it. Yeah, best feeling I believe I ever had in my life.
So from Paris, where did they take you?
I'm sorry?
Where did they?
From Paris, they put us on a train, and we headed in these boxcars, 40 to 50 to 60 men in a boxcar with a, I guess it's probably a 40, 50-gallon metal metal can in there. That was our latrine, and they never opened the boxcar until we got to Stalag 12A, which was at Limburg, Germany. But from time to time, the Air Force would catch that train running and would never leave an airplane until fighter planes would never leave until that engine was blown up. And in the process of shooting that engine up, there were rounds going everywhere. So at one point, some fellas got killed in those boxcars. But thank God, I never was in one where the bullets came through. So we went to Dalag 12A in Limburg, Germany, where we were first met by the Red Cross, and we became official prisoners of war. And we got our numbers there, and were registered. And from then on, you had a little security. Before that, if they killed you, they just throw you off the railroad tracks, and nothing would happen. But from then on, somebody would have to be held accountable if they killed you. And that was not much comfort, but at least more than we had before them. We went from there to Stalag 4B in Mühlberg, Germany. It was a NCO camp. Only non-commissioned officers were there from every nationality imaginable. And I got to be with some of my men there, some of my friends, and they pulled us out. That couldn't have been a non-com camp either. It really wasn't. No, I'm sorry. There were privates there too, because three of my squad members were there. But they pulled me out and sent me to a NCO camp at Kustrin, Germany, which was Stalag 3C, east of Berlin, across the Oder River, about 12 miles. And that was the last prison I was in until the January the 31st, 1944. The Russians overran that prison, not even knowing that we were there, by the way. Mm-hmm. And just pulled up there with those big guns. And the Germans with their Royal Tiger tanks, and the Russians with what we called a Stalinsky tank, just boresighted each other and got at it. Because the Oder River was the last natural defensive barrier that the Germans had. So they were going to fight for it big time. And to get back, when the Russians, there was no formal ceremony took place. Everybody just saw that the guards were all gone, and those that the Russians could catch, they killed. And so I had the option of either trying to go with the Russians across the Oder River into Berlin and on west, where the Americans were coming to the east, or go east, but God only knows where, because I didn't know what was to the east. Only thing I did figure that if you go east long enough, you're going to pass Texas someday. And so that's what I did. I just started following the Russian supply line going back east, and I wound up going down to as far south as Krakow, Poland, and I went up to as far north as Warsaw, Poland, where I caught a train that took me to Moscow, and that's where I had that experience trying to teach a little Russian girl how to jitterbug.
Well, you didn't stay there very long either, because you moved on to Odessa.
Yeah, no, I didn't stay there any length of time. Well, I'll tell you what happened was I was up on that boxcar having a good time drinking vodka and dancing with a little Russian girl. And some Russian came and said, "Have you said that sign over there? Have you seen that sign?" I said, "What sign?" He showed me on a pole over there, and it said, all former Allied prisoners of war report to Odessa, Russia." And I said, "Odessa, Texas, I know. Where's Odessa, Russia?" And they said, "Well, as a matter of fact, those trains are being made up right over there going to Odessa." So I went over and got on one of those trains, made me a little nest over in the corner, and got off that train in Odessa, Russia, and they put me immediately into a big, looked like it was a big office building or headquarters building or something like that. But we were prisoners there, and they had a guard around the outside, and we were not allowed to go out, and we were prisoners, but the food was all right. So, you know, we weren't complaining as long as we were eating.
Well, you had pretty good food all the way across this journey, thanks to the fact that earlier on, you had come into a village or town that had been deserted, and you found the equivalent of a department store and a whole lot of silk stockings.
Yep. I got 60 pairs of real silk hose, and I knew what those were going to be worth. I just knew it because my mother and my sister back here in Killeen, Texas, had commented about, well, we've got such a hard time. We haven't seen any new silk hose in years and blah, blah, blah. So I said, boy, I've got something here that's worth money. So that whole system over there was barter anyway at that time in prison and every place else. So I took those 60 pairs of hose, and in the same place I found some knee-length fur jackets that had to be like ermine or something because of the price tag on there in Reichmarks was big, big money. So I took one of them and I put it with the fur next to my body, took one of them a little larger size and put it on the outside, and I was snug as a bug. And I took those hose and stuffed them down inside of that. And incidentally, in that same building, big, like a super Sears robot, they had a car dealership. And I got a little Russian soldier showed me how to hook up and fire up a Volkswagen wood-burning bus. And I drove that sucker out through a plate glass window with a little Russian going nuts.
Well, it's too bad you didn't get...
Of all things, found me, and I see him circling up, and I said, oh, he wouldn't waste time on a little thing like this. Yeah, he probably would. So I ran, got in a hole, and he set that little sucker on fire. So I'm back on the Ankle Express.
Well, what happened in Odessa?
How's that?
What happened in Odessa?
Well, in Odessa, we just didn't do anything except sit and anticipate getting a boat out of there, get a ship out of there. There was a big squabble going on between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. Roosevelt was a non-player. He was about to die. So Stalin and Churchill were getting at it. Churchill said that when this war is over, the Allies are going to have trouble with the Russians. So we need to keep these, like, 160,000 Russians that they're liberating over in France or places like that, where the Germans had them working and even working as soldiers. And so in that argument, you know, we didn't know anything about this argument. I have since learned all about that from reading a book called Soldiers of Misfortune. It tells exactly what happened as they gathered up American prisoners and Canadian prisoners and British and moved us down to Odessa. And I'm convinced that I caught the last ship of bringing Russian prisoners in. I'm convinced. They shot, incidentally, the first man that got off the first boat that came in there with Russian prisoners. They killed him at the end, a lieutenant colonel. They killed him at the end of the boardwalk. They came down. And we took that ship out of there to join the American forces in Italy. Went across the Black Sea through Istanbul by Greece into Cairo, Egypt. Turned around, came back across the Mediterranean to Italy.
And then
that's where I joined the American forces again.
Right, and then you made it to Boston.
Oh, and then I stayed about maybe 2 weeks there or something, and that's where I got my medals and some pay and so forth. And out on the deck, the 2 days out from there, heading for Boston, I ran across a friend that I'd known in high school, and that friendship, he had been a bomber pilot, and he had flown his missions and was going home. He'd been a bomber pilot flying out of Italy into the oil fields of Southern Europe. And we met on deck out there and had us a great time. And that's where we went inside into the hallway, the corridor. We were standing by this door talking, and because it was too windy out on the deck, directly, some guy opened this door and jerked the door open and said, well, if you're coming in, come on in. I said, coming in where? He said, to
confession.
And I said, confession? He said, yeah. I said, oh, man, I'm sorry. This buddy and me, we've never been to confession in our lives, and we hear we're only going to be on the sea 10 days, and we ain't got enough time, so we just go on. So we went on outside, and we've been together ever since. I got out, went to the University of Texas, and found us a niche down there, and he came down, and we've been very close friends ever since.
Well, it's some story. It's all chronicled in the book To D-Day and Back by Bob Bearden, subtitled Adventures with the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment and Life as a World War II Prisoner of War.
Bob Bearden. Incidentally, if they can make this a part of that, our website is www.boblbearden.com. www.boblbearden.com.
Okay, Bob Bearden, thank you so much.
I enjoyed it, Bearden.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Our thanks to guest Bob Bearden for sharing his World War II experiences. His book is titled To D-Day and Back, Adventures with the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment and Life as a World War II POW. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.